The Tom Woods Show, episode 767.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, don't be envious of me just because I'm getting the best shave of my life. Join me. Get your free trial set from Harry's. That's a razor, five-blade cartridge, and shaving gel. Plus, they're tossing in a post-shave balm. And all you got to do is pay three smackers for shipping. So head over to harrys.com. That's H-A-R-R-Y-S.com. And enter code Woods. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. Talking to Pastor Larry Bean today, who is pastor of Salem Lutheran Church in Gretna, Louisiana, near New Orleans. He is just a great libertarian overall. Great guy, great libertarian. Well, at least I think that's what he calls himself. We're going to double check about that. But if he doesn't, then the world makes no sense to me. He also teaches apologetics, economics, and government at Wittenberg Academy, an online classical high school. And I thought we could just have a more or less spontaneous conversation about things going on in the world, about PC inside and out of the Christian world, but also about the vexing issue of Romans 13, which comes up quite a bit. So a lot to talk about with Pastor Larry Bean. Pastor Bean, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Tom. It's good to be here. I got to tell you, my dad's stock went through the roof when I told my son that I was going to be on the Tom Woods Show.
Oh.
We're big fans, so thank you.
Oh, that is fantastic. Well, I can't believe it took me this long to figure out that I should have you on. Everything I see from you, I just love. I mean, whether it's on Facebook or that letter that you wrote to Loyola University New Orleans about Walter Block, that was just devastating. I mean, I wrote a nice letter on Walter's behalf, but then when I read yours, I thought, well, I'm proud to take the silver medal if Pastor Larry Bean is involved. So that was so beautifully and masterfully done. You smashed them so badly. And the beautiful thing is that as a Protestant, the funny thing is, you know, for the type of people who run Loyola University, who, I mean, I can't fully speak for them, but I know these types, believe me. I know a lot of these types. They really can't stand the traditional Catholic Church. So
yes,
they really do care a lot more about the opinion of a Protestant. So I was so glad that you came along. You know, they couldn't care less about me. You know, I'm totally dispensable. All right, let's talk about, I just have a bunch of things that I want to talk to you about because you're a smart guy and I love what I read from you and you are a PC slayer and everything else. And yet you're a Lutheran pastor. And when I visited the Harvard campus for a Mises event earlier this month, I was walking by University Lutheran, which we knew of as UniLu, which probably should have been like Looney Tune because of these people. And I actually took a picture of their new sign, which more or less indicates that everybody is welcome at University Lutheran except Martin Luther. In fact, I was almost going to send the picture home with the caption, just the way Luther would have wanted it. Are you Missouri Synod?
Yes, I'm a Missouri Synod Lutheran. And of course, it's, in Lutheranism, it's like in Roman Catholicism, there are various sort of factions. And in Lutheranism, they're actually separate denominations. But my denomination tends toward conservatism and, very traditional sort of Catholic orthodoxy within our Lutheran tradition.
All right, so that's what I want to start off with this, even though, because this is not something that's exclusive to Lutheranism, but it seems like it's a big, big problem over there. You don't have to deal with it probably as much in the Missouri Synod, but the largest of the Lutheran groups is the Evangelical Lutheran Church of America. And there, I don't quite get what they consider their historic attachment to the man and Martin Luther and the thought of Martin Luther, in the same way that I don't see how anybody can be a leftist in the Catholic Church. You look at 2,000 years, whatever you want to say of 2,000 years of Catholicism has nothing to do with leftism whatsoever. Is that how you feel about the ELCA?
Yeah, it's an analogous situation. Martin Luther was quite a conservative figure, and the Reformation splintered into different factions, but the Lutheran Reformation was very, very conservative. Even our liturgy was virtually identical to the Roman Catholic liturgy of the time. But the ELCA is a recent creation. It was an amalgamation of several denominations. It was formed in, I believe, in the early 1980s. And it very quickly became more of an expression of leftist political ideas over and against traditional theology, as the church has confessed it for 2,000 years.
So that then leads me to another question, which is, would you describe yourself as a libertarian?
Absolutely.
All right. Now, I understand that obviously what matters are the theological principles of Luther and not his private opinions on various things, but it does seem like those two bled into each other, not just in Luther's case, but in the case of many theologians. And I would not in any way describe Luther as a libertarian. What do you see that Luther missed?
Well, you know, first of all, the name Lutheran was kind of it was put upon us as a kind of an insult or to try to detract from our Catholicism or our Christianity, and so it's kind of an unfortunate thing, but the name stuck, of course. We don't acknowledge every single writing of Martin Luther. We acknowledge some of his writings are in our confessional documents that constitute what Lutherans confess. It's called the Book of Concord, and it was published in 1580. So, you know, in many cases, Luther was a brilliant, brilliant theologian and doctor of the church. Sometimes he just said things that were really goofy. Sometimes, you know, a lot of his recorded writings were done around the dinner table where he was just sort of cutting up. So Luther is oftentimes greatly misinterpreted or misrepresented by, you know, people on all sides. So, you know, we acknowledge some of Luther's writings, but certainly not all of them. But basically, we are in the continuity in the Catholic tradition, going back to the apostles, the Reformation. You know, we really see it as an unfortunate conflict within the church, but it was, from our point of view, something that was necessary to happen to restore an understanding of the gospel that had been kind of covered up through corruption in the Middle Ages. So Luther tended to be a person of his times. He was very much a statist. He, you know, he really, you know, in those days you had an imperial form of government in Germany, in Europe. And there was really no sense of any other way to govern oneself. I mean, today we don't have an emperor, at least not officially. You know, we have republics all around the world. We have various democratic institutions that just didn't exist in the Middle Ages. And so, you know, the world has kind of changed in the way we govern ourselves. And 500 years from now, it may be quite different as well. But the principles of Christianity and of the church, that's still, we still confess that no matter what type of government or governance that we may have in the future.
What about Romans 13? I'm curious about Luther's interpretation of it. And here's three things. Luther's interpretation of Romans 13, your interpretation of Romans 13, and thirdly, the accusation that maybe, in the case of Christian libertarians, the ideology is pulling the theological cart, you know, is the horse pulling the cart, that really we want to be libertarians, and the Christian texts don't really allow it, so we come up with these tendentious interpretations that allow us to sleep at night.
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's a text that is often used as sort of, well, here's your knockout punch. You can't be a libertarian because Romans 13. Okay, let's move on now. But I think we really need to look at the text. And as far as the way it's been understood throughout the ages, I think a lot of it has to do with what kind of governance you live in. I mean, if you live in a monarchy, if you live in a democracy, if you live in communist Russia, your what you owe your quote rulers, it may be different than if you have a benevolent Christian king or if you have a secular republic. There's a principle that is being confessed in Romans 13. And here's what I think is the main misunderstanding or misreading of Romans 13. Verse 1 says, and I'm using the English Standard Translation, which I think is illustrative. Let every person be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and those that exist have been instituted by God. Well, governing authorities, what's the first thing that pops in your mind when you hear those words? It sounds like government. And in your mind, you know, it at least for me, I don't stop with government. I put a the in front of it. Obey the government. Because there is no just government. There is the government. Because there's only one. It's a monopoly. But when you read the text in its original Greek form, it says authority, and it says the higher authorities. So, you know, there is authority in the world that prevents that keeps us from chaos. Authority is not a bad thing, and libertarians aren't against authority. You know, for instance, in your home, you have children. If you have a family, you have children. You exercise authority over the children. You tell them when to go to bed and all of that. And in that context, that's a godly use of authority. But notice it's not state authority, it's private authority. Or, you know, in society, I mean, no libertarian wants to live in a society where people can just take your stuff and kill you. We do believe in authority. We believe in justice. We believe in, as Romans 13 says, you have authorities that reward good behavior and punish bad behavior. And, you know, so libertarians are not against law and order. But when you narrow it down to the state and say that this authority must be an expression of a monopolistic use of unchecked power that can be abusive, and you know, you're not allowed to criticize it because, as this text says, the authority is the minister of God, I think it's a misuse of Romans 13. Let me give you a couple of examples of private authority that I think does come under this rubric, because I interpret Romans 13 much more strongly, I think, than a statist does. Because I don't see it as the government. I see it as all authority by which God uses to keep order in society. Like, for instance, you just went on a cruise, right? You had that great experience that would have been wonderful to be there on the Contra cruise. I was on a cruise ship a few years ago, and I thought it was really interesting that the captain and the officers wear military insignia, but they're not government. They work for a private company. But yet, under maritime law, these private civilian people have authority. I mean, the captain can put you in the brig, and you can't just call your lawyer or wave your passport. When you're on the seas, he is the authority. And I would say Romans 13 obliges Christian people to submit to his authority. And to not beat other people up and steal their stuff on the boat, you know. So that's a private authority. It's not necessarily a state authority. The other one that I wanted to point out is the world's largest institution in history is the Roman Catholic Church. And what does the Roman Catholic Church do? It divides the whole world up into geographical districts called dioceses, and they're each overseen by a bishop. And there's a system of canon law. There are rules. There's punishment for transgression, and at the same time, it's voluntary. It's not a state. I mean, the Vatican is a state, but that's a different story. But Roman Catholics live in this sort of voluntary government. I live in the geographical confines of the Archbishop of New Orleans, but I'm not under his authority. I'm under a different ecclesiastical authority, and we all coexist. So, I mean, this is kind of a libertarian, even an anarchist model of governance. It's voluntary. We can shift from one governance to the other. And yet there is authority that Romans 13 obliges us to obey for good order in our world.
All right. I've got a couple comebacks to that. Follow-ups.
Sure.
I guess I should say for the record, just so everybody understands, that obviously you and I have a different assessment of the Reformation and its merits. So just that's on the record so that people don't write to me. Why didn't you push back? Because I don't want to – that's not why I invited you. But secondly, as you well know, there are other texts that could be used as so-called proof texts about the state and wielding the sword and taxation, that if you were to read them, let's say, without any prior ideological commitments, you could see why somebody would think that the state is being endorsed in these texts. So
sure.
Again, doesn't it sound like you have to get yourself into contortions to have them read some other way?
You know, it's funny because with taxes, people do come up with the render unto Caesar, what is Caesar's, render unto God, what is God's. And a lot of people don't understand the context of what was going on there. For observant Jews to be in the temple, they shouldn't have even had coins with Caesar's image on them. That was considered blasphemous. So they were supposed to have changed their currency outside before bringing it inside. And really, Jesus was, when he says, bring me a coin and whose image is on it, he's really turning the charge around on them. You know, when he says, give to Caesar what is Caesar's and give to God what is God's, well, is there anything that belongs to Caesar that isn't also God's? So, you know, Jesus kind of left he left it kind of ambiguous. But people will say, well, Jesus says, you know, that taxes are moral or what have you, or he's endorsing the Roman state. Here's a passage from, if I could just read just a couple verses here, from Matthew 17 that I think it makes me laugh every time I read it. It's because of I think here's how Jesus views taxes, and it's beginning at verse 24. When they came to Capernaum, the collectors of the half shekel tax went up to Peter and said, "Does your teacher not pay the tax?" He said, "Yes." And when he came into the house, Jesus spoke to him first, saying, "What do you think, Simon? From whom do kings of the earth take toll or tax? From their sons or from others?" And when he said, "From others," Jesus said to him, "Then the sons are free. However, not to give offense to them, go to the sea, cast a hook, and take the first fish that comes up. And when you open its mouth, you'll find a shekel. Take that and give it to them for me and for yourself." And you notice that Jesus's goal here is not to offend them. He doesn't say, "Oh well, you know, we must pay this or we owe it." In fact, he says, "Who owes? The sons of the kingdom. We belong to Christ's kingdom. Do sons owe taxes? Do the rulers of the earth tax fairly? Do they really? Do they tax their own sons? Do they tax their own political constituencies?" And Jesus says, you know, just pay it so you don't offend them. And I really believe in that. I believe in paying everything the state says we owe. I don't advocate, making a martyr of yourself to try to protest taxes. I think it's a better way to oppose unjust taxation is with the power of ideas rather than sitting in a jail cell. It's not as cut and dried as statists like to make it out to be. I mean, absolutely. I think there's something to be said for if government does provide genuine services, then, you know, we should pay for those services. But on the other hand, we're not given a choice. You know, the government does things and then taxes us. Without really asking us as individuals, you know, are you going to drive on this road? Are you going to use this particular government service? And it's really that's not a good way to do business, really. I mean, every function government does can be privatized. And the libertarian argument is this is a much more humane and efficient way to live together in society and to provide goods and services. I mean, would you rather go to the Apple store or the DMV? Private businesses have to compete, they have to innovate, and they don't have the power to put a gun to your head and take your money. So really, libertarianism is nothing more than saying, let's privatize things that government is currently doing. And there's really nothing in Scripture against that.
All right, I also want to talk about political correctness with you, and we'll do that after we thank our sponsor. Folks, reviewing the demographic statistics for the Tom Woods Show reminds me that I have an awful lot of men listening to this show. I'll just leave it at that. And I'm willing to bet a lot of you men are shavers. And if you're like me, you want to have a nice close shave, but for some reason, you just can't get the blade to work the way it works for other people. They have this smooth shave, and they look like they've got a baby's bottom for a face, and you've got a face that's all hacked up and bloody, and you look like you're in an axe murderer movie. Well, that does not happen for me anymore since I started using Harry's. Closest and most comfortable shave I've ever gotten. I don't have to use electric anymore. Now, here's a great chance for you to have the same experience I did. Harry's will send you their popular free trial set, which comes with a razor, a 5-blade cartridge, and shaving gel. And all you gotta do is pay 3 smackers for shipping. Plus, enter code WOODS at checkout, and they'll throw in a post-shave balm for free. So how about that? You get the razor, the five-blade cartridge, the shaving gel, and you enter code WOODS, and you get the post-shave balm for free. Head on over to harrys.com to grab this deal. That's H-A-R-R-Y-S, harrys.com, and use code WOODS. All right, I want to shift gears. First, I want to ask you, do I have permission? I don't know if it was published online or not, but do I have permission to publish on my site the text of the letter you wrote to Loyola for Walter Block?
Oh, absolutely, Tom. Absolutely.
I'm telling you, if you're listening to this, I'll link to it at tomwoods.com/767. You have to give yourself the pleasure of reading this letter. I just looked at it again before you and I spoke, and I thought, well, I'll read a couple paragraphs on the air, but I couldn't figure out which ones to read. I want to read the whole letter, and it would take too long. It is such... I'm a tough critic of writers. I'm a tough, tough critic. And I can't see one syllable I would have changed in this letter or that I could improve upon in this letter. It is so, so beautifully written. You smashed these so-called open-minded, tolerant PC people, smashed them so beautifully that I'm telling you, if you're listening to this, you're depriving yourself unjustly of a tremendous pleasure. So go to tomwoods.com/767 if you have not yet seen this letter, and chances are you have not. Now, let's say a little something. I want to shift gears to political correctness just because that's just something that drives me so crazy. It drove me crazy when I was in college. Then I kind of forgot about it for a while because I thought that's something you worry about when you're in college and it's only on college campuses. But now in my day, those kids have now graduated, and they're spreading it into every nook and cranny of society to the point where people don't feel safe expressing their opinions on a wide variety of subjects. We know everybody will get in line when certain subjects come up, and there's an official position that every CEO, every political figure, every newscaster, every college professor will hold, and if you don't hold it, you'll be hounded. And it's unbelievable. And I've read a lot of stuff by you on this that is so on target that I think you are as tormented by it as I am.
Absolutely. And you mentioned Dr. Block. I have to just say, you know, I have not met a more gentlemanly, academically gifted and just kind-hearted, friendly person than Walter Block. And the way he was treated was not just shameful, not just a violation of academic freedom, but it was downright un-Christian. You know, I'll go even further. I'll say it was anti-Christian. The way Dr. Block was treated was diabolical, and that's what prompted me to write that letter to the administration. It was very sad. And, you know, here's the irony. Again, like you said, I'm a Lutheran, and the Jesuits were formed basically to burn us at the stake. I mean, that was historically, that was their cause. And Walter Block is a Jewish atheist. You know, so the great irony is that that this Christian institution would persecute a Jewish atheist over his views on economics, which the Jesuits, ironically, you know, the early Austrian economics, the early history of Austrian economics includes the Jesuits of the Salamanca school. So there's such great irony here, and it's not funny irony. It's sad, tragic, and diabolical irony. And I hope that we move beyond as a culture. I hope we move beyond this straitjacket of speech codes. And you know, it's frightening. It's downright Orwellian. And another friend, I've not met him personally, but I read him a lot and I communicate with him privately sometimes, is Dr. Anthony Esselin, a brilliant Roman Catholic traditionalist scholar at Providence. And he's likewise taking a lot of heat for some of the brilliant things he writes in Crisis magazine. I mean, why people who disagree with us? I mean, Walter Block and I disagree with each other on some issues and we debate and at the end of the day, we're friends. I don't understand why. And especially why Christian institutions, Jesuit institutions, I mean, the Jesuits of all people, they are scholars, you know. Why can't they be scholarly? Why can't they be Christian? Why can't they be intellectual? Why are they using their power to beat down honest inquiry? That is the stuff of the Soviet Union and of Nazi Germany. That is the stuff of concentration camps. And we really culturally need to deal with this before it becomes, you know, an episode in history that We will be shocked to read about, you know, people 100 years from now will be shocked to read about what happened to Western civilization and American culture.
It's funny that a lot of the critics of the old church will say, oh, you know, before we had Vatican II, what a terrible, benighted, stupid institution it was. But now that we've opened the doors to the modern world, how much fresh air there is in it. You know, all this crap nobody in his right mind could possibly believe.
Right.
But the irony is that there was vastly more intellectual diversity in those days. Like when I think of the old style Jesuits, people who were ordained years and years and years ago, when you met one of those, you met a sharp, sharp mind who was not afraid of debating any subject, wasn't going to cower, but was glad to have the opportunity to have an exchange of ideas. And I think of, for example, I knew a guy, he's deceased now, a priest named Father James Sadowski, who was an old-style Jesuit, extremely knowledgeable, and he would discuss and debate with absolutely anyone. And yet, by the time of his death, the Society of Jesus had become so leftist that, well, I guess probably about 10 years, let's say 10 years before his death, he was one of the people I sent my manuscript for the book The Church and the Market to, because I thought, this guy's extremely smart, he knows everything there is to know about what I'm writing about, and if I make any mistakes, he'll tell me. And he basically loved the book. He had a couple minor comments, and he loved it. But he would not allow me to mention him in the acknowledgments because he said, look, I'm in a retirement home for Jesuits and I'm done fighting. I don't want to spend the rest of my days fighting this stuff. So I had to keep it quiet until he died. I mean, that's and so these are the people who are going to liberate us from the bad old days when, you know, it really is, you know, it really is a case of, you know, the liberator being worse than the alleged oppressor.
Yeah, it really is. I'll give you a happy irony, Tom, that I think you'll appreciate. I went to a Jesuit high school, and it was kind of in that post-Vatican II transition. I mean, it was late 70s, early 80s. And I learned to write from the Jesuits. So ironically, they gave me the tools that I needed to write that letter to Loyola that you enjoyed so much.
All right, well, they've slightly made up for educating Voltaire, I guess, now.
Right. No, but you're right about that. And it's not just a Roman Catholic thing either. We see it in Lutheranism, which, as we talked about earlier, has kind of fractured along the lines of the more traditionalist wing and the more politically accommodating wing. We see it all across Christianity, but certainly in Roman Catholicism. Roman Catholicism, of course, is the largest branch within the Christian Church, and it's and so what happens in Rome affects everybody. And some of the things that the Pope has been saying, I know this has been extremely frustrating to traditionalist Roman Catholics and to us too, to us Lutherans. I mean, we admired Pope Benedict XVI. He was a great theologian, a great writer, but the current Pope is just maybe some of it, to be charitable, some of it is lost in translation. But it seems like every time.
No. That's way too charitable. I appreciate the effort, but it's misplaced.
Well, you know, every time he says something, all the handlers come out and have to reinterpret what he says. If you want to have a little bit of a laugh, Tom, you might want to link to this on your page. There's a Lutheran pastor named Hans Feeney who does this. He does this Lutheran sarcasm kind of site. I'll have to send you the link, or you can Google it. But he does this skit called Frank the Hippie Pope. And it is quite funny. It's not, I wouldn't say it's blasphemous. I mean, a lot of traditional Roman Catholics have laughed at it. So you might want to check it out if you think it's worthwhile. You might want to link to it. But it really does sum up how often the Pope will say something that's utterly politically correct but contrary to Roman Catholic doctrine, and then his handlers have to come in after the fact and sort of massage it and try to make lemonade out of lemons. It's very sad and it's confusing, and the world needs right now, the world needs strong Christian confession and leadership. We don't need this kind of muddying of the waters. This is a crucial time, I think, in our civilization's history. And I'm also honored to see men like Anthony Esselin, men like yourself, from Roman Catholicism and other great leaders of across the board from Protestantism and Orthodoxy, working together to promote our Christian truths and to stand up for Christian liberties and all people's liberties. I mean, religious liberties are all liberties, and these things are coming under attack from the state, and I think a lot of people are starting to wake up to that.
I'm certainly going to link to Tom Woods at tomwoods.com/767 to an episode I did. I've done episodes on the economics of Pope Francis a couple of times, but yes. I did a bonus episode of the show really on church politics and how Francis fits into that. I did it as a bonus episode because it wasn't really connected to libertarianism per se, but a lot of people were asking for it. And I did it with Roger McCaffrey, who's an old hand in traditional Catholic circles. And I find it to be, frankly, quite terrifying. And no, I don't think the guy can be explained away. It really is a horrifying, horrifying situation. And I think, you know, you talk about people who have to explain away his crazy statements. And what I keep saying is, you know, whoever at L'Osservatore Romano or in the Vatican press office is massaging his words to make them sound reasonable, why don't we just cut out the middleman, make that guy the Pope? Wouldn't we save ourselves a lot of trouble? Just make that guy the Pope. And really, there's no question about it that there are people who voted for Jorge Mario Bergoglio because they thought, okay, well, I heard he's for the poor and I like that, who now looking back on it are saying, what on earth did I do?
Yeah.
And he's about to add maybe close to 24 voting cardinals. Mm. And they're going to be all, and again, he presents himself as, I'm the humble Pope and I love everybody. Unlike all my predecessors, I am humble and I love everybody. But his predecessor, if John Paul II had run the church the way Francis does, there would never have been a Francis. Francis, it is absolute ideological conformity down the line, and I'm going to humiliate and demote you if you disagree. On the other hand, Francis is about, it looks like he's reached an agreement with the highly traditionalist Society of St. Pius X to reintegrate them into the church, which is sort of a Nixon to China kind of thing. Nobody would expect that he would do it, and yet maybe he's the only one who could do it. So he's a very, very strange figure. And now I think I'm getting a little bit off the subject. We've got to talk more often because there are a lot of things that you and I could talk about that I would enjoy talking to you on the phone about. But I think our phone conversations would make good episodes. So let's cut out the telephone middleman and just make them into episodes.
Sounds great, yes.
Tell people about your blog and how they can find it.
Well, I have a blog. It's Blogspot. It's called Father Hollywood. There's an inside story of why it's called that. But basically, I use it to put a sermon archive. I put my sermons up there. Of course, I'm really far behind on posting them because I'm so busy. But I do have some political stuff and some libertarian stuff. I have been published on Lou Rockwell, I think 12, 13 times. So if you go to lourockwell.com, you can plug in my name and you can read some of the things that I've written, more pertinent to libertarianism, economics, and with a tie-in oftentimes to Christianity. So people can read stuff there. Mostly I'm too lazy. I use Facebook to kind of put out ideas. I probably shouldn't do that. I probably should reinvigorate my blog. So maybe I have incentive to do that now.
There's just, even though it's tempting to use Facebook because it seems like you get more engagement, there's less permanence with it.
That's true.
So that's the tricky part.
Absolutely. Yes.
Well, anyway, of course, I'd like to see any content from you regardless of where it appears. And I'm glad that I now have an episode with you. But we're just skating on the very surface of so much great stuff. So I hope you'll agree to come on in the future. And thanks for talking to me today.
Well, thank you, Tom. And I can't tell you what a great honor it is to be here. And please keep up the great work. You're doing the Lord's work, and you're a great voice for human dignity and human freedom. And I'm honored to be on the show.
Thank you very much. All right, I got a few things I think you're going to want to hear about, including some very interesting speaking engagements coming up. One of them particularly interesting for reasons you'll see in a moment. But first, remember the episode a couple days ago, and I did a whole email about it, about how my mother, just in the past year, in 2016, has figured out how to sell products as an affiliate. She's an affiliate marketer, selling a lot of stuff pertaining to game rooms, so you've heard me mention her site because she went through Bluehost, so she gets the mention that I always promise everybody if they use my affiliate link. Well, if Mom uses the affiliate link, she gets the mention too. That's the rules, you know? Them's the rules here on the Tom Woods Show. Well, anyway, she's gotten pretty darn good at it. She sells high-ticket items, which means they carry a big commission. So it's the sort of thing where you check your email and you're surprised to say, oh, wow, I just made $50 because somebody bought a, you know, whatever, whatever. So how did she do that? It's hard to do that these days, given how crowded the internet is. And the way she did it is, well, she had a couple of teachers. And those teachers are going to be showing exactly how they taught my mom. And they're going to be doing that on November 3rd at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. So sign up to watch for yourself and see how my mom is doing this, because it's a very, very nice way to earn some dough if you can make it work. And here's how to make it work. So sign up at tomwoods.com/Andrew, because Andrew Hansen will be joining us with Sarah Young to give us an overview of that. So tomwoods.com/Andrew. You'd be crazy to miss that. Then I've got some speaking engagements that I think you might find interesting. December 1st, I'm going to be in Orlando, which is not far. It's less than an hour from my house. Then February 25th, I'm going to be in San Diego for a Mises Institute event there. Let me double check that that actually is February 25th. Yes, it is. Then May 20th, this is way in the future, 2017, I'm going to be back in Seattle for the Mises Circle event there yet again. But April 4th is the fun one, because on April 4th, I'm going to be speaking at the Yale Political Union. And if you've ever seen the Yale Political Union, it's a circus. You give a presentation on some subject, and then the gloves come off, and people can shout at you and yell things and bombard you with questions. And I'm going to be speaking on the general subject of the secession of American states, speaking in favor of that idea. And I've chosen that topic for a reason. But anyway, that's going to be a lot of fun. So if you live in the New Haven area, April 4th, 2017, just save the date. Throw it in your Google Calendar and remember to show up and support me. I got details for all these events on my events page, which is tomwoods.com/events. Let's see what's coming up. Doug Casey finally will be here this week. Then I got, well, we got some interesting stuff about the free market and the environment coming up. We got Scott Horton coming back to the show by popular demand. I was going to have him anyway, but by popular demand, I couldn't resist. So Scott Horton's coming back on. Lots of great stuff to tune in for. So thanks for listening. See you again tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.